Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the recent report by the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, that finds the income of America's top 1% more than tripled in the last few decades, while middle-class incomes grew by less than 40%. Harvard economist Richard Parker, author of The Myth of the Middle Class, joins us to explain how these latest figures confirm what a lot of Americans already knew, while validating the Occupy Wall Street movement's stark comparison of the 1% at the top versus the 99% at the bottom. Then we'll look into the rise and fall of a criminal website, Dark Market, the title of a new book by BBC investigative journalist Misha Glenny, Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops, and You. The author of the bestseller McMafia that explored global multinational networks of organized crime, Misha Glenny, turns his attention to a new frontier of crime and warfare that is essential reading for anyone who owns a computer. Joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Glad to be here, Ian. Nice to talk to you.
And the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, the research arm of the Congress, has come out with a study that isn't really news, but at least it verifies a feeling that's out there in the kind of political zeitgeist, and to some extent reflected by the Occupy Wall Street movement, which has spread across the country and around the world. From 1979 to 2007, the average household income for the nation's top 1% more than tripled, while middle-class income grew less than 40%. That's the sort of bottom line. So there you have it, the 1% versus the 99%.
Well, you know, this has been a problem that some economists have noticed now for almost every year since the 1970s. I mean, you mentioned that I wrote a book called The Myth of the Middle Class. That was based on my Oxford doctoral dissertation, and I published it with Harper and Row back in 1974. And the argument back in 1974 was that there was even then a discernible difference between the upper and the lower middle classes, and that the gap between the two of them was growing. It was too early to focus on the top 1%, but you could see that the very successful post-Second World War system of compressed wage inequality and wealth inequality, with strong unions, high levels of progressive tax, high and progressive levels of taxation, and an expanding social welfare net rather than a contracting one, were all driving an America that was not only more egalitarian than it is today by far, but also one that was growing much more successfully than we are today, or have been, frankly, for the last 30 years.
But Richard Parker, again, he teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. So in terms of, though, the struggle between oligarchy and democracy, or plutonomy and democracy, the recent history indicates a kind of ebb and flow. You know, back in the Gilded Age, you had the tremendous amount of populism, which actually was on the left with William Jennings Bryan, a coalition of urban and rural poor. They were vastly outspent by the plutocrats, and then you had the accidental reformer in the form of Teddy Roosevelt, who, after McKinley was assassinated, he then turned the tables back with the reforms, and then the plutocracy came back in the 20s, the Roaring 20s, and ultimately leading to the crash in 29, and then a more of a democracy came back under the New Deal and all of those economic reforms. and so on and so on. I mean, I don't need to go through a long history now, but sure. We seem to be back in a new gilded age. So what do you think of when the next sweep is going to come in the other direction to restore democracy?
Well, I think it's going to emerge out of this ongoing stagnation in the wake of the 2008 meltdown. I think that you can see both in Europe and in North America a rising sense that things aren't getting better. And while this is producing clear fissures in both parties, the Republicans can't come to an easy accommodation in terms of an ideological solution, and the Democrats, while the opposition to Obama from the left is more outside the party than inside the party, are also beginning to recognize that the kind of Geithner, Summers, Bernanke economic policy that's been followed for the last 3 years is fundamentally not only inadequate in practical terms, but inadequate in terms of analytic and prescriptive terms. So it's a failure on multiple levels. And in those kinds of vacuums, combined vacuums of practical outcomes, of policy, and of ideas, new ideas rush in to fill those voids. And, you know, what you're getting on the Republican side, interestingly enough, is, in my view, a recycling of a fundamental libertarian wing of the Republican Party, but one that's having a hard time making peace with the evangelical religious wing of the party. It's the Ron Paul versus Michelle Bachmann story in some sense. And the temporary coalition solution is Mitt Romney. You know, I just don't think that what I can foresee of a Romney administration is going to get us out of the box we're in. He will have to, for a variety of reasons, continue to focus on cutting public spending. And it's not clear to me how, when you have an enormous low-wage manufacturing base operating outside the United States, how getting to equilibrium by cutting will ever work unless you have a goal of driving American wages and living standards down to Asian, in particular Chinese or Southeast Asian living standards. On the Democratic side, I think that it's a failure of ideological and political imagination as much as anything else. I think that Obama demonstrated something very clearly, which is that the rhetoric of a more engaged and powerful democracy and of a more engaged a regulatory state that's committed to social justice is what people will vote for. The Obama crisis is of delivery, not of promise. And so I think there will be candidates who pick up on how well the promise did with voters once the Obama era is over.
But in terms of this CBO report, the nation's top 1%, their income has more than tripled since from the decades between 79 and 2007.
Yep.
Whereas the middle class has grew by less than 40%. So that's 275% to 40%. So there's no question that's a pretty stark statistic. It also plays right into this new political movement that has spontaneously erupted here in the United States, the 99% versus yep. the 1%. So the question then becomes, when do we get back to a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, if indeed such a thing is a reality, as opposed to a government of the plutocrats by and for the hirelings of the plutocrats with the help of the plutocratic press for the plutocrats. So I think that I think you have to make the distinction of this sort of coalition of the enablers of the plutocracy are our political class, because we have a money-based political system. And so guess what? Mm-hmm. The people with money buy the politicians. It's that simple.
Right. Well, I think on some level it is that simple, although I think there's another layer, which is over time the emergence of a large upper middle class with a language of bureaucratic rationality and of the supremacy of the rationality of markets over the messy rationality of political democracy have become the helots of that class of wealth. There's no sense that I have that there's a revolt brewing in what 50 years ago was called the new class that was emerging, that was a combination of both the professional classes and of a part of the managerial class that was supposedly not tied to the interests of the owners of great wealth. But in terms of preference, in terms of ambition, that much larger upper middle class seems deeply wedded toward any attempt possible on its members' part to move closer to that 1% rather than to govern that 1% in a way that transfers wealth and power to a broader base that includes the upper middle class. That's I think, the real crisis.
But the crisis has come about because of the social engineering of taxation, hasn't it? And the consequences of years and years of gradual transfer of power to or the lack of responsibility to pay taxes on the part of the wealthier and wealthier. Now you have that situation where the wealthiest, the hedge fund managers, only pay 15% capital gains, if they pay anything at all, because they can keep deferring it. So it seems like starting with Reagan, the trend began where the people just below the 1% are the ones that got stiffed.
Yeah, I actually don't think that's true. I mean, I think that there are three things that I would add to that analysis as sort of the material consequences of a shifting tax regime, because I think the shifting tax regime is an important part of the story. I think a couple of the things I'd add. One is the shift of relative global output away from the United States and away from the North Atlantic advanced industrial democracies toward Asia and toward the developing world in general. That, since the 1980s, has produced a fire hose of imports that are low cost and easily consumed through what I call the Walmart network. I mean, in effect, what you do when you spend a dollar at Walmart is spend 50 cents in Beijing, China. And that restructuring of global trade to move so much of what once constituted the prosperity of the American manufacturing base and with it a prosperous blue-collar skilled labor population offshore is a huge problem in and of itself, and it's connected to the decline of unions. It's not that the decline of unions led to that situation. So that's one. I think the second is that, and this is uncomfortable, I think, for people who don't want to listen carefully to the logic of it, that in some ways the struggle of the left to create gender equality and the right of women to work and earn equally with men, perversely through the structure of the family, has heightened inequality. Here's what I mean, which is that if you look at the spread growing between the upper middle and lower middle class, not the top 1%, but the ninth decile and maybe the second decile at the bottom, what you find starkly is that 75% of the families that have incomes in the top one quarter of the American income pyramid are two income earning families. That is, there has been the creation of an upper middle class out of what in other terms would simply be two middle, or in some cases slightly lower middle class incomes. That is, two elementary school teachers together can have what is by most definitions a modestly upper middle class income. Two lawyers married or two doctors married actually are within the top 1 or 1.5% of top income earners. Conversely, the number of single-member households or households with only single earners make up the great majority of the bottom 40% of households as well, too. And, you know, when a marriage breaks up, and in particular the ex-wife is left to raise the children, there's an immediate shift of her and her children from the top quarter to oftentimes the bottom quarter to the bottom third. So there's an element of demography and a desire for gender equality in pay that through the institution of the family has actually contributed, not at the very top levels, not at the very bottom levels, but in sort of the shoulder levels at the top and the ankle levels at the bottom, to widening inequality. Now, that's not an argument for asking or forcing women to leave the labor force by any means, but it's a comment on one of the complexities that we on the progressive side of the political spectrum need to be more honest among ourselves about. There's a third element that I'd emphasize too, which is we've been living through a series of policy-sponsored or law-generated technological booms. The purest form of it is the rise of the personal computer and the Internet, and there's a tendency on the part of Wired magazine and other enthusiasts who think that the passing of Steve Jobs is the death of God in the modern world, computer technology and the Internet are somehow the pure drivers of a modern world. They're not. But there have been these technological waves, which have then in turn been monetized by the stock market, which at three different times in the last 30 years have produced enormous stock market bubbles, quite separate from, you know, the last real estate bubble that we went through that led to 2008, the great stock market boom of the late 1990s, on which Bill Clinton floated the second half of his presidency. Was in fact a policy-driven technology boom that fed into the stock market in a way that produced unimaginably high price earnings ratios on new companies that had in fact enormous prices and no earnings whatsoever. So you've got the technological problem, you've got the demographic problem to mix in here as well, too. None of this takes away from this central fact that a very small number of senior managers and equity owners have harvested unprecedented wealth out of these changes. But I think that we need to contextualize them to understand the driving forces beyond tax policy change, which is important but not exclusive.
But Richard Parker, isn't there an explanation, though, in a fundamental sense? That my understanding is that productivity and household income have tracked pretty consistently in parallel, but starting in the 70s, productivity increases and household income starts a slow, steady decline, indicating that capital is the beneficiary of productivity and labor is not benefiting in any kind of commensurate way. In fact, this has led people like the economist Rubini, who predicted the 2008 crash. He's just saying that Marx was right, you know, because that's an old Marxian argument as well.
Yeah, and Nouriel is certainly not a Marxist, so coming out of his mouth, it's a little bit like a latter-day Joseph Schumpeter predicting that socialism will triumph. You know, I'd sort of put Nouriel aside. Nouriel has an aptitude for headlines and television cameras that's specific to Nouriel. On your point about capital versus labor, I think that the complicating factor here is that increasingly labor has become the owner of capital through mutual funds and pension funds. And as a consequence, there is a dark truth here, which is that much of the middle class, but especially the upper middle class, through its pension savings, has been a beneficiary, a collateral beneficiary, of this enormous run-up in wealth and the concentration of wealth at the top. Again, I don't want to suggest for a moment that there's some kind of parity or equality between middle-class savers who are trying to supplement what they anticipate will be meager Social Security benefits with the Warren Buffetts of the world. That's not my suggestion. It is that the old and fairly simple divide between calculating returns to capital and calculating returns to labor are not nearly so simple to do. That's not a technical problem. That's a significant analytic problem. Some other time we can talk about how that could be addressed.
Right, but that's not to suggest, for example, that had they privatized Social Security, which they still want to do, whose 401k is doing well today? And
absolutely. Look, I mean, again, I want to be very clear what the lesson of Goldman Sachs in 2008 has been is that wealthy individuals and firms, in many cases, were free riders on stock market booms that were being fueled by the savings of the middle class. In other words, each month, billions upon billions of dollars would have to pour into the market as mutual fund managers tried to figure out what to do with these deductions from people's payroll checks. And the sheer fact of the volume of money that the fund managers had to invest versus the slow-growing number of stock shares for sale contributed to a classic imbalance of supply and demand that helped drive those prices higher. And who were the beneficiaries? Well, of course, the mutual fund managers themselves, the brokers, the traders, certainly, the hedge funds that increasingly sold their products to pension funds and insurance companies. And so those more than clever upper middle class and aspiring wealthy and super wealthy were able to ride this giant Mississippi of middle-class savings down to Mississippi on a gold-plated riverboat. But it is also to say that, you know, the middle class does look above the median of American incomes increasingly to gains from non-wage sources as workers grow older. So that was the point I was trying to make.
Well, one of the ironies that I've tried to explore recently and spoken with Senator Sanders about this is that, you know, the Goldman Sachs index for the commodity markets, he argues, and others do, like Michael Greenberger, who was with the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, is that there's enormous amount of speculation in the commodities market for driving up the price of gasoline and food.
Absolutely.
And the paradox there is a reflection of what you just said, is that people's mutual funds and pension funds are being used to...
Oh, yeah, right. No, I mean, our savings are being used to drive up the prices of the things that we buy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Well, I thank you for joining us today, Richard Parker. It's been an enjoyable conversation.
Ian, it's always good to talk with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts. He was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, and His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about this new criminal network, Dark Market.
Want you lost in your own fear. No compass, find your way out. A troglodyte, a derelict barn campaign. But ten, the filthy rich.